back to We the People Radio. Second hour here with our guest, William Kay. I'm Aaron Ryan.
And I'm Bill Cundiff.
And I'm Bob Martin.
Bob Martin's where all the music comes from, just in case you're wondering why you don't hear him say much after that. He is. He says a lot.
He's a music man. He's.
Do you get to do everybody's music, or do people pick their own?
Oh, it varies from show to show. But, some people like to pick their own. Some people like to let me pick it, and some shows are a combination
of
both.
Well, I just think you should tell them to just stop working on it.
Come on.
You're better at it than we are.
Yeah, hey, our sponsor this hour is Powerhouse Solar. If you're looking for solar, get a hold of Bruce and Sue over there.
For people who actually are going to be there.
Been there a long time, yeah. Their phone number is 275-6600.
That's their fax number.
Oh,
I knew you
man.
Were going to say it. I was looking at it.
5600, excuse me.
I willed you
well,
to say it wrong.
Now they'll get a million faxes. They'll thank me for that.
No, everybody will call and get me, 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 me. Be like, that guy on the radio is an idiot.
Oh, man, that guy. Time to cut that out.
What show was that anyway? Never mind.
Powerhouse Solar. Give them a call.
We treat all our sponsors like this, so feel free to get a hold of us if you'd like to join the crowd. You can find all that information at wethepeopleradio.us.
You should give the number one more time.
Yeah, the real number.
275-5600.
Area code 530.
There you are.
Ta-da! All right. Back to William Kay and Hitler.
Yeah.
I've been dying to say that.
He's right beside me.
Well, you know,
they
throw Hitler around all the time, you know, and it's always like, Hitler this, Hitler, everybody's Hitler. You know, everybody you don't like is Hitler. Everybody who does something you don't like acts like Hitler. But it is pretty interesting that Hitler does figure into this this climate stuff. Kind of?
Well, the ideology,
Third Reich was the greenest regime the world's ever seen. That is an established fact. They passed a law in 1935 called the Reich Nature Protection Law that unprecedented around the world. It required that every German landholder had to consult the local environmental sort of cliques before you could make any modification to your land. Within the first few years of the Third Reich, they created 800 parks. They created the word organic foods, was created by the Nazi environment minister, agricultural minister.
Really?
He was a real fanatic, and he almost compelled the German government under Hitler to convert all German food to organic. I could give you just countless examples of how the leaders of the Third Reich, Himmler, Goring, were just wilderness fanatics. Like Goring, you know, even when they were losing the war, he was just obsessed with sort of reintroducing old species into the German forest that had been previously extinct. They were animal rights nuts. Both Himmler and Goring switched to using human experiments, doing scientific experiments on humans, because they thought that doing it to an animal was cruel.
God, that's not sound...
Yeah, they were trying to bring back the oryx or something, weren't they?
That sounds like PETA.
Yeah.
Yeah, they really do sound like PETA. And yeah, you're right. He brought back quite a bit of this. You know, none of it ever sort of stuck. The reintroduction of these ancient species and that, but it just shows where their minds were at. These were forest fanatics, wilderness fanatics. They tried to, you know, if you ever, what are they? I don't know what they call it these days. Back then, they call it Darwin, selective forestry or minimal, you get rid of the clear cutting. There's none of that sort of stuff. Also, this sort of very selective eco-forestry. They impose those laws all over Germany, and they're disastrous, right? Talk to any lumberjack about just chopping one tree down amidst a bunch of other trees. You know, it almost kills every lumberjack that chops a tree down. It's a very dangerous way to do things, and it's a very non-economical way of doing things. But that was something that the Nazis imposed on German forestry. I could give you probably a dozen examples of green laws that were passed by the Third Reich that existed nowhere else in the world at the time.
Well, keep going. I'm kind of curious.
Many of which
are still
in effect today.
Yes. These sorts of laws were revived in the 1980s. in the 1970s. To some extent, that they, even now they don't stick. But the main thrust of it was, what was called the Reich nature law. Keep in mind, there was a huge nature preservation movement in Germany dating back to the late 1800s. To understand it, it was very much an aristocratic dominated society. They did not want to see market relations applied to land. These were the, they did not want to see free trade in agricultural goods. Even today, most farms in Germany are rented out. There are individual aristocrats in Germany today that own 200, 300 square miles of land.
Wow.
And this is all rented out, and some of it's urban, some of it's rural. But it's that clique that are still very much, driving the environmental movement, were driving fascism before. There's a profound hostility to capitalism. I mean, here's an example. Think about, California. What if they threw all the public lands of California open for development and more or less told the construction industry, sort of, knock yourselves out, build whatever you want?
Yeah.
There would be this sort of mass building spree going on. People wouldn't be paying $3,000 a month for a small apartment in Santa Monica. There would be the wealthy landed elites of the coastal regions would lose out. That was always the great dread in Europe, that if you really had a free market system in land, it would more or less make landlordism redundant. And they certainly didn't want to see free trade in agriculture, and they did not want to see a whole bunch of forest cleared for agricultural purposes. That would just increase the supply of agricultural goods. So there was a lot about capitalism that the aristocracy didn't like. And they certainly didn't like democracy. They were very accustomed to dominating political structures. America had a revolution in 1776. Europe never had that revolution. Even as late as 1914, like the eve of World War I, France was the only republic in all of Europe. Every other country was a monarchy, and many of these countries were absolute monarchies, where the king was, appointing cabinet members, the king was, arbitrarily and capriciously setting taxes and sentencing people to death and what have you. That was the norm across. This was the Europe of the Tsars and the Kaisers. Mm-hmm. They never had a revolution like America had. America was a revolutionary society, and the aristocracy hated it.
Yeah, I'm sure they did.
After World War I, there were these revolutions across Europe, but then there was this profound reaction, to eliminate democracy. Germany had a revolution in November of 1918. The Tsar flees to Holland. The aristocracy are all still there. And then they begin a process of remobilizing themselves to retake power. And getting the Nazis back in power was this aristocratic restoration. One of the books I condense on my website, absolute gem, it's called The Reich and the Royals, and it's about the relationship between, the aristocracies and the monarchies and the European fascist movement. The author was an investigator with, Interpol and these international police agencies. They're still trying to hunt down all the stolen artwork. A third of all the artwork in France was stolen. That's just France is one example. During the fascist era, all the museums were cleaned out near the end of the war. The Germans were rounding up all stuff. They found a guy recently in Germany who had $1 billion worth of art in his basement.
Wow.
So there's still police forces around the world today looking for all this stolen art. The author of the book, The Reichs and the Royals, was one of those investigators. That book came out in 2005, Oxford publication. He was given an audience before the Queen and Prince Philip to help research the book. And he was also given access to a document that had never been made public before. It was in the possession of the United States Army. They had a complete list of the Nazi Party membership. And this was never made public before. And within that membership list, there was a list of all the princes of Germany that were Nazi Party members, and there were 270 of them. And 90 of them were members of the Nazi Party before the party came to power, but there were four or five other German fascist groups. Every German prince was an active fascist activist before the Nazis took power. Hitler had promised that he was going to restore the Kaiser to power. And the 2 years leading up before Hitler was granted power, the crown prince would tour with him and would speak on stage before him. People were coming to hear the crown prince. They weren't coming to hear Hitler. Another one of the Kaiser's sons had Nazi card membership number 12. Hitler's card membership was like close to 100.
Oh, so no,
you really have to view...
He was an early joiner.
It was a real campaign by the aristocracy to retake power, to bring back the good old days, which weren't ancient times. I mean, Germany was an absolutist monarchy until the end of World War One, and the Nazis are resecured in power in 1923. You know, everyone talks about, you know, Mussolini's great march on Rome. And how he sort of, they try to re-describe it as though it was some sort of revolution. Throughout the entire time that Mussolini was in power, the Kingdom of Italy was a kingdom. It was ruled over by the Savoy family. King Victor Emmanuel III appointed Mussolini to prime ministership before the March on Rome. This was done after the fact. And then 20 years later, King Victor has Mussolini arrested and deposed. Mussolini later said that the entire regime, the fascist regime in Italy, was a diarchy, that the king was actually exerting more power than Mussolini was. And that is a story that gets repeated right across Europe. In Europe today, there's still 9 monarchies. Some of these are the wealthiest people in the world. And where you don't have a monarchy, you have countries like Germany and Spain. Sorry, Spain is a monarchy. And Italy, where the aristocracy is still there. One of the books I condense from the website is called The Dukes, and it's about the British duchies. There's some 30-some duchies in Britain. The Duchy of Westminster owns a quarter of central London. By my estimate, he probably owns about 1,500 high-rise buildings in London.
Wow. Oh, wow.
And that's a family that came over with William the Conqueror. But that's a pattern you see right across Europe. The Duke of Alba in Spain owns over 2,000 square miles of Spain. In Spain, colloquially, they're known as the 50. There's still 50 dukes and princes own probably 40% of all the land in Spain. That's a pattern you see right across Europe. And it was an effort by those people to reclaim power, to do away with democracy and free speech and things that they'd always hated. You can get speeches from these people who talk about how they have devoted their lives to suppressing democracy. They just fundamentally and emphatically believed that the masses did not have a right to participate in politics. They did not believe in free speech. They adamantly believed in censorship. They didn't think that all you're going to do is sort of stir up the mob. So sure. That sort of mentality was very present in Europe. And by 1940, keep in mind that Germany was not the only country that had a fascist dictatorship. You know, by 1941, from the gates of Moscow to the White Cliffs of Dover, every European country is a fascist dictatorship. Germany was the 9th country to have a fascist dictatorship. The movement takes its name after Italy. That was the fascist party of Italy, but, Austria, what is now Yugoslavia, what was then Yugoslavia, these were all fascist dictatorships before Germany was. So it was a European-wide movement, and it was led by the monarchs and the aristocrats. And one of the key things about that book, The Reichs and the Royals, is that list of all those German princes who were, Nazi party activists, that was not made public until the year 2005.
No kidding. 2005? That's a long time to keep some of that, I guess.
Nobody thought to ask for it.
I guess.
They're very good at, the book itself sort of centers around this one family called the Hessens, and they were the princes of this small region of Europe, of Germany. And every member of the family, swastika on the armband, hardcore Nazis, they all survived World War II. One of them was Göring's right-hand man. And he concludes by describing what their life is like, the early 21st century. They never got 1 acre expropriated from them. They own hotels all over Frankfurt. They own vineyards. They own tennis courts and golf courses in Germany. They own farms. They own, you know, all kinds of apartment complexes in Munich and places like that. They never lost a single, you know, building or anything. They hung on to all of their assets. And that gets repeated over and over again in Europe. You know, if you take a closer look at Europe, there's places like Monaco and Liechtenstein and Luxembourg and Andorra and San Marino and Malta. There's all these absolutely medieval spots all over Europe where there isn't even the slightest pretense of democracy. And many of these people, like, you know, the Prince of Liechtenstein, these are multi-billionaires. And almost every one of them has converted a little enclave into a little money laundering racket as well. But if you take an even closer look at Europe, all of those countries, even the ones that are sort of, you know, broader sort of modern countries, they are, you know, owned and operated. They're like a giant jigsaw puzzle piece of these little sort of princedoms and dukedoms. After the 1918 revolution in Germany, it became illegal to be officially a prince, although there was never any expropriation of their land and property. What the princes then did was just change their first name to prince. So they're still there. Bavaria, which is one of the biggest provinces of Germany, still has a king.
The prince formerly known as Prince.
Yeah, not that prince who sort of blew his brains out on dope. Although well, these guys are famous for doing the same, believe me.
Oh, my gosh. We have to take a really quick break. Sorry, I blew
okay.
it.
Okay.
Got derailed with the princes formerly known as Prince. And when we come back, we do have some people who want to know, what about letting all these hordes of refugees in? How's that factor
didn't
into
really
their...
settle well with...
Yeah,
with
how's that going to factor into their game, and how'd they get away with it? You're listening to We the People. Join us online, wethepeopleradio.us.
Well, you filled up my head with so many lies. You twisted my heart till something snapped inside. I'd like to give it one more try, but my give a damn's busted.
We find that German battleship that's making such a fuss. We gotta sink the Bismarck, cause the world depends on us.
Hit the decks, a running boys, and spin those guns around.
But when we find the Bismarck, we gotta cut her down.
The old classic Bismarck.
DJ Bob's giving me goosebumps.
Ay.
We love our DJ
as opposed
Bob.
To goose step. Okay, you had a skill testing question.
Oh, my gosh. Well, so we have people in the chat room wanting to know what's the deal with
Germany and the immigrants they've let in.
How does that factor in?
That's not settling well with them.
I've thought about this. I have 3 points on the top of my head.
Wow.
Point number one. I mentioned earlier that sort of, you know, the fascist mentality is really anti-democratic, and they really don't care what the general public thinks about government policy. As far as they're concerned, you know, they're not entitled to have a say. Immigration is a prime example of that. Should any sort of humble citizen of the United States or Germany say, well, I don't want to see all this immigration. Well, that's it, buddy. You know, the argument's over. I mean, the government has decided there's going to be a certain amount of immigration. And if you don't like it, then you're some sort of racist, you're some sort of bigot, you're some sort of throwback.
Yep.
But this is something that is not up for discussion. This isn't something that we could all sit around and talk about or, you know, discuss in a democratic society. Let's have how much immigration should we have in this country? Where should they come from? No. That is too delicate a topic to let the mob even think about or publicly talk about. So you see that, and anybody who complains about immigration, you know, outside the circle of polite company immediately. Second point, obviously elite groups, it's already pretty obvious, so you bring in a lot of unemployed people into a labor market, you're suppressing wages, supply and demand. That's pretty obvious, and it's obviously one of the motivations that goes on with these sorts of immigration policies. And it's one of the reasons why they really don't want, you know, the great many-headed, the great unwashed mob having a say in this, because they're obviously not going to be too crazy about programs that suppress wages. What isn't talked about is, you know, a lot of these people end up on welfare. Certainly in Europe, that's what's happening. But welfare is the, you know, the greatest gift to landlords there ever was. You know, the libertarians talk about, let's kick everybody off welfare. I'd love to see that happen, because, in any sort of modern industrial city, about a quarter of the population wouldn't be paying rent. In the real world, 80% of the money that goes off in any sort of social service, welfare budget, within the end of the month, that's in the hand of landlords and slumlords that own the business enterprises in the low-rent parts of town. So pouring a lot of immigrants into these ghettos, it's great news for the big landlords of Europe as well. And the third point is about this, the unholiest of alliances between the European aristocracy and the Arabian aristocracy. There you find another world where you have these absolute monarchies again. Not even the slightest pretense of democracy. And these are indubitably the richest men in the world, the king of Saudi Arabia and the sheikh of Abu Dhabi, the emir of Kuwait. Nobody's got the money they have. I mean, nobody. Bill Gates doesn't have the money these people have. And they are famous for bribery. And I think that a lot of the oil monarchies, and there's about, off the top of my head, I could probably name what have you in the Arab world. They are having a lot of influence in European politics through the bribery, through the corruption. The king of Saudi Arabia has probably built 1,000 mosques around Europe. They really do have a sense of, get as many Muslims over there, pour as many Arab-speaking people into Europe. It's all part of their little crusade. That is not just some sort of conspiratorial thing. It's pretty obvious. But at the very highest levels, the European aristocracy and the neo-feudalist rulers of the Middle East, there's a common purpose there. There's a mutual animosity to just, normal sort of conventional democracy, human rights, free speech, things like that. They all agree that they don't agree on that. So I think there is an alliance between the European aristocracy and the Arabian elites to further this project. And there are people who in Europe, like wealthy landlords and certain employers who are, materially benefiting from this wave of immigrants. And the bottom line is that the public is completely disenfranchised. You're not allowed to complain about this. I mean, you people live in California. You've seen this whole thing. There's been, probably excessive immigration there, and it is just foreboding to complain about it, unless you really want to get branded as being a very bad person.
Yeah, right.
But won't they ultimately lose their grip of power as the population sort of shifts over to the foreigners? Won't they lose their power base?
They're probably not thinking that long term. Keep in mind, the protagonists here are, to a large extent, the oil monarchs. Their power will expand. The European elites, I think there's a lot of American politicians who are in the pockets. I don't know if these guys, they all wear these robes. I mean, if they have pockets. But they're instruments, they're tools of these Arabian elites. I don't know, did you guys catch that article? Here's the story. In June of last year, one of the senior princes of Saudi Arabia gave an interview to a Jordanian newspaper. This is one of the mainstream newspapers in Jordan. And he was wrapping off, and he said that his family was personally bankrolling 20% of Hillary Clinton's campaign. She spent $1.2 million. That comes to $2 billion. That comes to $240 million that the Saudis gave the Clinton campaign. It was when people started reading it. People outside of the Arab world started reading it. There was a lot of panic. It got pulled off the website. The Jordanian government later said that they thought that must have been the result of some sort of hack. But you can get cached copies of that article. that kind of money is definitely flowing into Europe, and they're influencing a lot of politicians. So, yeah, they're basically engaged in treason. I hear what you're saying. Down the road, you're going to end up with this huge Muslim population.
Yeah, sure.
It's going to be completely unruly.
And it's going to start at the lower levels and work its way all the way up.
And their goal is to take over those societies, impose their own form of rule, you know, Islam.
Sure.
And subjugate everybody else. They're pretty straightforward about it.
But keep in mind, a lot of these European aristocrats, you know, they never believed in women's rights. They never believed in democratic rights.
Oh, that's true, too.
They believed in sort of just these, you know, just wrenching dictatorships. There's an excellent book, I reviewed it in one of the previous ones, called Political Repression in 19th Century Europe. And it's just about what an absolute hellhole Europe was from, you know, 1800 to World War One. I mean, if you tried to organize a public rally to advocate for democracy rights or for, you know, for voting for the adult population in Berlin, you know, cavalry would charge at you. And then later in the evening, detectives would go through the hospitals looking for anybody with a saber wound and arrest them. I mean, that was Berlin in the 1870s. The old guard in Europe, the old aristocratic old guard, is absolutely opposed to democracy. So it isn't as though they have got some sort of, you know, real political, moral complaint with life in the Arab monarchies. You know, it all comes down to ultimately freedom of speech and freedom of assembly and you know, no taxation without representation. I mean, the sort of basic, what we call human rights over here, they don't exist over there, and they never existed in the good old days of 19th century Europe.
Right. So I guess it really wouldn't matter because they've survived. Their power has survived for decades, whether it's a monarchy or not. So I see your point.
Taking, you know, example, you know, Prince Albert of Monaco. Now he's the head of state of Monaco. It's not a big place. You know, 40,000-50,000 people live there. He owns about a third of all the buildings in Monaco. He's a part owner of the Monte Carlo Casino. He owns banks, you know, for people to launder money through there. Plus, he's used those profits to buy up real estate all around Monaco, all over France and places like that. He's a multi-billionaire. He's a raving environmentalist. But when he is in Monaco, he's God Almighty. And, you know, you think, well, what's that doing in the 21st century? But you take a really good closer look at Western Europe, you'll find that all over the place.
Wow.
You know, Liechtenstein, Luxembourg, you know, Sweden is a kingdom, Norway is a kingdom, Britain is a kingdom, Spain, Netherlands. These are not monarchies. These are kingdoms. And it's not like the House of Orange-Nassau, the royal family of the Netherlands. There's no possible way to put a number on how wealthy that family is. They are multi-billionaires. They call it Royal Dutch Shell for a reason. They certainly don't have controlling interest, but, you know, the general rule of thumb is they probably own between 5 and 10% of that company, and that's the most profitable company in the history of capitalism. So all across Europe, you know, if you really just twist the microscope one more time, you see just how far from being a democracy it is.
So as far as the Green Movement goes, they can't lose, really.
They can impose it, and the fact that our guys seem unable to get the ball through the goalposts is probably absolutely frustrating to them. And I'm sure the advent of Donald Trump and the elimination of global warming from the White House webpage is probably caused some hand-wringing over the weekend.
Yeah, it's not going over real well.
We need to take a really quick break. We're going to come back with our guest,
okay.
William Kay. You are listening to We the People Radio. You can find us online at wethepeopleradio.us.
Just go ahead.
That was the theme song of the White House website change.
Okay, go back.
Goodbye, global warming. Because here in California, we're trapped with crazy Jerry Brown and his train to nowhere. God. Have you followed that at all, William?
Not very much.
Ugh.
I know a bit about Brown. It's not something I focused on. I know I once condensed a book that dealt with quite a bit with, you know, the damage that had been done to rural and northern California by the suppression of the forestry industry and you know, the suppression of that sort of industry. It's tragic. We have the similar sort of problems here, you know. It's California in particular. I mean, it has so much public land sitting idle. If they ever wanted that place to boom, they just a matter of flicking a switch, and it would happen.
We're sitting on the largest oil reserves in the world, but we can't have them. We've got all this forest that we can't really harvest.
So we'd rather burn it down
every year and spend
billions
of dollars on fire suppression than harvest it and replant it.
And then the Forest Service says they can't afford to keep the roads open in the forest. Well, if they
sold some timber,
they could actually do that. And you know,
it's tragic. It's very similar to British Columbia, which is sort of off the coast from there. There's a moratorium on looking for oil off the coast of British Columbia. It's also a place that's well known to have, you know, billions of barrels of oil and even more natural gas there. But now they've prohibited any company from even doing any further seismic testing or any other sort of geological investigation. That's against the law. I mean, we know it's there, but don't even look any closer. British Columbia has a moratorium on uranium mining, although it's well understood that there are vast deposits there. It's a place that, you know, it's in similar boat to the whole Pacific coast.
Sure.
You know, it's operating at, you know, a very small percentage of what its potential is. There's one congresswoman, I do not have her name, from Washington State, who has proposed really throwing public lands open for development. That is something that Americans should really get behind.
The bad part I think the new Secretary of the Interior is he's Zinke, is against turning the land back. But he's one guy. I mean,
he's sort of sitting on the fence, and a lot of Trump's nominees, they sort of had to dial things back a bit to get through the hearings. Hopefully they will sort of turn it on again, but there's the opposition amongst the rhinos, you know, the Republican and name only types, that are forcing these guys to sort of really dilute their opinions. Hopefully once they get through that hoop and they sit around a cabinet table and start discussing these issues like public lands, energy policy, climate science, they will be emboldened.
Yeah.
Well, I think forward, if Trump holds his ground and kind of reminds them why he appointed them, I think it could change back.
Well, and you kind of have to remember too that those laws would be made at the congressional level and carried out by the cabinet.
Right.
So the cabinet isn't the one that, like, you know, makes the decision.
You're in for a real legal and legislative war. I mean, the question is how much can Trump do without Congress? He wants to repeal a bunch of stuff.
The
stuff that Obama was doing near the end of his term, they all do. They set up huge tracts of land under the Antiquities Act.
Right.
And they say that this cannot be overturned. I just don't see how that could be legal.
Well,
can't rewrite the Constitution.
Nobody has monuments. We're talking specifically about the monument process. Monument ground is already public land. So it's just a redesignation, but it screws up public land grazing, potentially hunting, fishing, mining, you know, anything that could take place on that land. It has a host of restrictions. But Congress has the
Grand Escalante Coal Reserve.
Yes,
they're in Utah, Colorado. You know, one of the richest coal deposits in the world.
And Clinton screwed
declared.
That up. Yep. Well,
and that's such an outrage. And there's also, near there, there's a, in Canada, we have these oil sands, these bitumen oil deposits.
Right.
In that area, sort of Colorado, Utah, you've got these things called the kerogen deposits. It's similar. It's like a really immature oil, but it can definitely be turned into fuel. And there's like trillion barrels of oil there, and it got turned into, you know, public lands, public monuments. But there are some just mind-boggling fuel reserves in Western United States that, you know, American cannot, the American citizens cannot get access to. And, you know, it's, if they want, Trump's got his head in the right place, but he's in for a war to really open that stuff up for development. You know, you open that up and you invite in, you know, foreign investors. And wow, you'd have a massive economic boom.
Well, the big trick is that, you know, we have a couple of factors. If, in fact, he does things through executive order, not the rolling back of executive orders, but I mean new going forward executive orders, we'll see the same thing. If, in fact, someone else gets in there, it's easy to go backward on that. What you have to really do is enshrine it in law. Same, too, with the process of defunding. That'll be very popular, and that was done a lot during the George Bush administration when the House and the Senate were in Republican control. They defunded a lot of things. Problem is, when they do that, those laws are still on the books, and another administration can just add money to it, and poof, it's all back again. So I think everybody's really of the mindset, the Republican side is really of the mindset that, you know, we have to be systematic with this, and we need to roll these things back in a way that makes them harder to do again. And
well, it's to repeal a whole bunch of legislation. I mean, that Pruitt, he's been in the trenches fighting against environmentalists for a couple of decades now. He must know, you know, by name and number all of the bits of legislation that have got to go. But you know, there's, like I say, there's elements within the Republican Party that are not on side. So.
Well, they could start
with the view from up north is there. That's the real battle.
Well, the House will be pretty easy because there's a big, wide cushion there. The difficulty is on the Senate side.
Yeah.
You have 50 votes, and you need 60 in order to get beyond a filibuster of legislation or a hold. And if there's a filibuster or a hold, kind of dead in the water. But, you know, one wild card we haven't had in the past, I have a feeling a President Trump would have no problem calling out people who stood in the way of those things. That hasn't really been done a lot before, but I would imagine the pressure will be fairly great. And with, you know, Senate seats coming up for reelection in a few years, that's why, you know, the process of election is so great. You know, the people always have a way to kind of lean on them, and the bad stuff doesn't go on.
Sure.
You can hold
it up for 2 years, but in 2 years, there's going to be a whole bunch of folks up for re-election.
And so those people will think twice about, you know, jamming all of this because they have constituents. You know, if you look at the map of, you know, you look at the map of the country and how much of the counties, you know, you had 57 out of 3,100 counties in the country voted for Trump. I mean, those Democrats represent some of those.
I worry about John McCain.
He's
always been a global warmer.
Yeah.
In addition to being this, you know, pathological Russia hater, he's to my mind seems like a real menace.
Yeah, he is. And Lindsey Graham-nesty, and we keep hoping somebody will, you know, come and beat them, and when we get disappointed again.
Yeah, they keep bringing home the bacon though, so they get reelected. That's
frustrating.
What folks forget.
Well, the bad part is they're always featured on the media, too, like they're the spokespeople for the Republicans, and they're not. But the media likes to put them up there because their positions are frequently wrong. And it gets people all upset. And, of course, that's why we have news, is to get people all upset.
At least McCain is consistent. You know, if they want someone to, you know, rattle off his same line, he doesn't let them down. It's good to see that George Will got the boot. You know, the only, you know, American station that I can more or less tolerate is Fox. You know, I visit a lot of websites, and but man, they need a changing of the guard at that facility.
Yeah,
they've got a lot of guys I think who are stuck in the pre-Trump era, and it's time to rotate them.
I think they're in the process of doing that.
They were all so wrong about this. I mean, everything about what they said. You know,
well, they're still bucking a lot of it. They're still on the wrong side of this thing, and I just don't think they've learned.
You know, the guy that's kind of fun. Do you ever watch Tucker Carlson?
Yes, he's one of my faves.
I really like that guy. He seems to have just sort of come out of the fog here after the election. I think because he speaks out. you know, and hasn't mm-hmm. been a complete idiot and stuck his foot in his mouth, actually. That I'm sure that doesn't hurt him either. Megyn Kelly's gone, though, so that's kind of awesome. She's over
it. She wasn't exactly a good fit over there.
No, she's back.
Like I say, Fox, you know, well, the real story of the last election in America was the rise of social media. It was the rise of alternative media. It was radio stations like this. It was websites that people had an alternative. They didn't have to get everything funneled through, you know, five or six media conglomerates.
And I think a lot of that
the real story.
Yeah, and I think a lot of that was brought on by the dishonesty of the mainstream media. And I think they're going to have a hard time getting the trust of the people back.
The bad
after
part
the
is
the last few years people, of the shenanigans that they've been pulling.
Right, but people always say that they don't believe them. You know,
but
I mean, I get people who call me all the time, and they call me about something they saw in the news, and I always ask them, you know, do you think the mainstream media is telling you the truth? Well, no, but then they're mad about it anyway, right? I mean, I think people, I think we have not, as a society, been able to harness, to put a mental harness on our skepticism for media. We saw it on TV, therefore it's got to be ostensibly true. Even if they say they don't like it.
Well, to tie it back into the original topic, when I was investigating all the different ways these big European multinationals are affecting American media, I went down the list of the top television advertisers in the United States, and wow, you see a lot of like BMW and L'Oreal. It's one of the ways in which, you know, this whole sort of European thing is affecting American cultures. A lot of those companies are major purchasers of mainstream media television advertising. And a lot of their advertising there's a group in France called Publicis, and it's this mind-bogglingly huge marketing advertising company. And a lot of these companies go through them, so it's a very concerted and coordinated agenda. But nothing gets, you know, the mainstream media's attention like that. And a lot of those big European outfits are major purchasers of TV advertising time. And that's not going to change.
No, that won't change. I think people are going to have to just, you know, take a breath and wait and see. Some of this stuff is obviously pure hype just to keep people upset. I don't know, I guess maybe we're addicted to being upset. Maybe that's why these things still have validity along the way.
No, we're in the middle of the battle. And like I say, it was the social media, it was sort of alternative media sites, won the election for Trump. I'm not a huge fan of Breitbart. I do visit it regularly. But I think I can't remember the actual number, but in the months leading up to the election, they had like 16 million regular viewers.
Wow.
That was a blog 10 years ago.
Yeah,
and
no
now
kidding.
It's rivaling some of the mainstream media networks. And there's a lot of those websites out there that are doing that. And that's that the genie is out of the bottle. And we just have to keep pressing forward with that and doing really good research.
Yep.
And showing the sources of our research, and we will increasingly marginalize a lot of the mainstream media.
Yeah, keep track of what's...
In Canada now, almost all the newspapers are bankrupt. Same as the New York Times.
Yeah,
they're having a lot
there.
Of financial difficulties. They're slowly but surely becoming blogs. You know, they're descending down into the blogosphere.
Sure, they've stopped reporting news.
And it's so good to see that happening.
We need to take one more quick break here before the top of the hour, and it will be the top of the hour. We've yet run out of time again with our guest, William Kay. And we wanted to know what you think will happen with the UN. So when we come back, maybe we can throw down on that one. You're listening to We the People Radio. Join us online, wethepeopleradio.us.
There's an old piano and they play it hot behind the green door. Don't know what they're doing, but they laugh a lot behind the green door. Wish they'd let me in so I could find out what's behind the green door.
That'll be Europe's new theme song.
I think we know what's behind the green door.
I think we do, too. Okay, so what about the UN? What's happening there? They're just a pain.
Well, it's going to be another arena of struggle. I mean, it's hard to believe that the United Nations was originally founded to advance the interests of the English-speaking world, but that it got co-opted fairly quickly, or about a few decades into its existence, and it has, you know, become one of the principal instruments whereby the English-speaking world has been victimized. Now, keep in mind that this whole Kyoto Protocol and the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change and the United Nations Environment Program, this whole global warming campaign, the only countries that are really suffering from this are Canada, the United States, and Australia. Every other country is getting a pass, or they're a country like Western Europe that didn't have any fossil fuels, and this was part of their original agenda.
Well, because we're the
global warming camp. Go ahead.
Those are the only nations that are actually abiding by the stupid rules that they're putting out.
Well, most of the countries got a pass, like India and China.
Sure.
From the get-go, said we're not going to, you know, actively suppress our economies. If you're suppressing energy, you're suppressing the whole economy.
Sure.
So they got a pass. You know, the only real victims are Canada, the United States, and Australia. Three of them are vast countries with enormous natural resources regarding the energy resources. These are countries, if they allow them to bloom and blossom, would rapidly surpass Europe. And you would have a situation like you had in the latter part of the 19th century where millions of people would simply migrate out of Europe to Canada, to the United States. There's a lot of skilled tradespeople, entrepreneurs in Europe. If America was allowed to boom, if they really threw open public lands for development, millions of Europeans would again migrate across the Atlantic and put on roots here. And that's not a win-win situation because, you know, the sort of European landed interest would lose from that. So this whole thing was a campaign to sabotage primarily the North American economy.
Sure.
And the United Nations was the principal vehicle through which this campaign was launched.
Can you, you know, and every time you think about stuff like this, don't you, in the back of your mind, you have that, like, the scary narrative of, oh, my God, what if it was Hillary that was president?
Ooh.
Yeah, I know. See,
World War III and America, you know, it would be economically hobbled.
Oh. Yeah.
Yeah. There would be...
The crushing would have been complete.
Ghost towns from L.A. to New York.
Yeah. William, we appreciate you coming on again. It's been...
My pleasure.
Thanks again, a million.
Great conversation.
We are chatting next week with millennials from Berkeley about what's going on. The conservative.
I saw the ad. Looks like fun.
It is going to be fun. The Republicans at Berkeley are being crushed by their peers. So he's very chatty. I think we're going to like Peter Van Voorhis next week. Thanks a lot, William. We
My
really
pleasure.
Appreciate
Bye-bye.
It. Thanks to Powerhouse Solar for helping make the show possible. For information about sponsorship, show ideas, all that good stuff, go to wethepeopleradio.us.